I'm Daniel Chacon. Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire. Today, I am very honored to have in the studio two fantastic poets. We have Dr. Jeff Serkin, who is a professor here at the University of Texas, El Paso, in the Creative Writing Department, a colleague of mine. And he brought with him Matt Hart, the poet Matt Hart. And I don't know if you've heard of Matt Hart, but I have to tell you, Jeff, thank you for introducing me to his poetry, because I was absolutely mesmerized. And I can't believe I never heard of you before, but that's the way poetry works, right? There's so many great poets out there.
Absolutely.
And when you access one, that's it. You know, it connects you to other poets. So thank you, Jeff, for introducing me to him. He's an amazing poet.
Well, thanks for having us on today.
Yeah, thank you so much.
I know you're passing through El Paso because you're going to do a gig, but I want to talk mostly about your writing. And, okay, you know, perhaps we'll, you know, get into your music as well, inevitably. Okay. Because, in fact, a lot of your poems really sound like music. I mean, I just love them. They're like lyrics. But let me give a little brief introduction to who you are. His name is Matt Hart. He is the author of several books of poems, including Sermons and Lectures, Both Blank and Relentless. I love that title, by the way. Debacle, Debacle, another title I love. Blue Jay Slayer. In fact, I love all your titles. And the companion books, Radiant Action and Radiant Companion, the latter of which we'll focus on today. His poems, reviews, and essays have appeared in numerous journals, including the Academy of American Poets, Cincinnati Review, Columbia Poetry Review, Kenyon Review, and Poetry, all the journals that have rejected me. Matt, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thanks so much for having me.
There is so much to talk about with this book, Radiant Companion. I'm absolutely a Matt Hart fan now that I've read this, and I'm going to go back and read the other books. But I want to start off with actually reading a quote by a poet. And I remember encountering this line for the first time. It's just one line. And the line is, "The wolf appointed to tear me apart is sure making slow work of it." Do you know who that line is from, Matt?
Oh, I do. It's from Dean Young.
You know, it's funny because I read that line. I think I forget how I encountered it, but I read that line and that was it. I was a Dean Young fan on that one line, and I just started going into his poetry, and, you know, eventually I got his books. But you say in the acknowledgments that Dean Young saved your life.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little about what you mean by that?
Yeah, well, Dean was teaching in the Warren Wilson College MFA program for writers when I was there.
Oh, he was your professor.
He was.
You lucky man.
Mentor of mine. And when I encountered his poems for the first time, I knew that I had found somebody who had a similar spirit, who was interested in wildness and dissonance and association, but also the sort of human pang. Like, you know, Dean is somebody who's really interested in poems that perform with language,
right,
but that also say something about the human condition. And, you know, at the time that I started working with him, I didn't know exactly that I was interested in that as well, but I certainly definitely am. And he's just been such a great friend to me, and great mentor. He's an amazing teacher, amazing poet.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Let's talk about these two books, Radiant Companion and Radiant Action. First of all, they're referred to as companion books.
Right.
What does this mean? Why did you have to write, or why did you choose to write, or did the poems choose themselves to appear in two separate books?
Yeah, so I started writing Radiant Action, which is a book-length serial poem, about 5 years ago, and I knew that pretty early on in writing the sections of that I was writing a book that was kind of meditating on the ways that art can connect us and the ways that art can sort of change our lives. And I know that, you know, my life was certainly really changed by art in pretty fundamental ways. And somewhere along the way, it became kind of my job to write the sections of Radiant Action. Like, I would, every day I wanted to write a section of that book. And I decided that if I could finish a section of Radiant Action, I would allow myself to write other poems. And those poems are the ones that became the poems in the collection Radiant Companion. And what wound up happening was that while the sections of Radiant Action are meditative and sort of inward-looking and sort of pretty philosophical, the poems in Radiant Companion take the same themes and spin them out toward other mm-hmm. particular people, my radiant companions.
Right.
And so, you know...
That's why maybe a lot of the poems are dedicated to people you know, friends.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think of the books as being friends.
Mm.
That they're sort
friends.
Of walking through the world together,
yeah.
looking up at the sky and watching its supernova. But yeah, that's how they sort of came to be companion books. And, you know, there are lines in the long poem that are in the poems of Radiant mm-hmm. Companion and vice versa.
Right.
So there is a lot of crossover. The books really are talking to each other
right,
in a variety
absolutely.
Of different ways.
Yeah. The first book, Radiant Action, is what is known as a serial poem.
Right.
And for those of you who don't know what that means, basically it's a long poem. It's a one book length poem. There might be sections, but there's not individual titles. And Radiant Companion, on the other hand, is a book of poems with titles.
It's a new collection.
Yeah. And so it seems like in the first one, there's a lot more, I won't say experimentalism going on, because that's really an inadequate term when it comes to describing poetry that doesn't do what you expect. But it does seem a little bit more unconventional in the sense that it
it's
is
expansive.
A long poem. Yes. And that I love there's a certain point in the poem where you can't read it upright anymore. You have to turn it to its side, and
which
you know, people in a coffee shop might think you're crazy as you're reading it.
Yeah.
I've seen that done before. Edward Corral does it in his book, and I know a lot of poets have done it before. And also in the first one, I don't think, there probably is, you know, I'd have to look more carefully, but there's not very many periods. You know, you use spaces instead of periods. You do the same in Radiant Companion, but you use a lot more periods. And I'm wondering how those choices were made from one book to another and what it might represent in terms of the two works as a single endeavor.
Yeah. So you're right that there is almost no end punctuation at all in Radiant Action, the long serial poem.
Commas.
There are commas, but there's no end punctuation. Yeah. There aren't periods, there aren't question marks or exclamation points. Part of the reason is that I want to be able to end sentences, but rather than stopping them or putting up a roadblock with a period or something, I want to have a kind of rolling stop. I want to be able to like move from one phrase through one line, through one sentence, and to be able to play the phrase against the line, against the sentence, so that you can read a phrase and it means one thing. Connect it to the line, it means something else.
Right.
Connect it to the sentence, it means a different thing. I like the idea that the poem sort of keeps its momentum going, that the poem unfolds or sort of blossoms, that it rolls out of itself. So in Radiant Action, that's the sort of modus operandi. But in Radiant Companion, there are some poems that have actual end punctuation, and they tend to be more narrative.
Right, absolutely. You're a lot more rooted in this one than the first book.
That's right.
And whatever that means, because you could be rooted in language. You're rooted in the language always. You're always rooted in something.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think, you know, the choice in Radiant Companion to actually use some end punctuation typically is in poems where I'm doing something that's a lot more narrative. And where there are actual, where you know exactly where you're located,
right.
You know who the speaker is, you know what's happening, as opposed to some of the other poems that are more in the mind or that are more sort of expressive of a particular feeling.
Right. That's interesting, because I wanted to ask you something about enjambment anyway. In the second book, the one we're kind of focusing on today, Radiant Companion Poems, you have this poem called Ode to a Nightingale.
Oh, yeah.
And there's this one.
I made
one...
that title up myself.
Awesome. And it's a poem about a poet. And I hate to do this. I hate to say you when I'm referring to the narrator, you know, and rather just the speaker of the poem. But nonetheless, I sense there's a lot of Matt Hart in these poems, especially
Absolutely.
Since one of the titles even says Matt Hart.
Yes.
But it's about a friend who sent you a voicemail with a poem that he had just written on it, a poet named Russell Dillon.
Mm-hmm.
But there's this one stanza that just I had to read over and over again, not because I didn't understand it, but because it was so beautiful. And this is one of the poems that doesn't use any periods, but that uses rather a space and then a capitalization of the next word.
Mm-hmm.
What I really loved about it was the enjambments. I'm going to read it. It's on page 119. It says, It was 2 hours after that. The birds already chirping their muted green sun. I made a cup of black coffee. The dog ate. And then on the next stanza, a soap bubble. And it caused me to think of that enjambment and how you do, you know, I love the way you do that. But usually when a poet does that, they don't have that. They usually do use periods and achieve the enjambment that way. But what you're saying is that by not having the periods, rather just having that space, that it emphasizes the enjambment even more?
Yeah, it emphasizes the enjambment. It emphasizes the sort of connectedness of the phrases, that I don't think of these as sort of separate things. They're all a piece of the same poetic cloth.
Yeah, I like that.
Somehow. That they do go on and on, that this is a thread that's being sort of unwound, as opposed to like little bits and pieces of things that I'm like sort of manipulating. There's a dreamy quality, hopefully, there's this kind of dreamy quality, especially in that poem, to the flow from phrase to phrase, line to line, sentence to sentence.
Right.
And it kind of suggests that there's that the individual phrases are not simply little objects to encounter, but that something else is happening in the poem.
Yeah.
What is the other thing that's happening in the poem for you? Like, are these poems objects for you? Are they, you know, what are these poems accomplishing for you? Does that make any sense?
Yeah. You know, one of the things that they're sort of allowing me to do is, and I was talking with you about this earlier today, is that writing for me is a way of getting to the things that are on my mind that I had no idea were on my mind.
Right.
And
makes sense.
One of the ways that I do that is by sitting down to write, and I don't really have an idea, and I start describing whatever's in front of me, or maybe a conversation that I just had, or something that just sort of occurred in my life. And once I get started in that, I don't want to stop. I want to be able to follow the words where they lead me, where they take me, so that I can understand something about the present moment, so I can understand something more about the human condition, so that I can understand something more about what I'm concerned with. And periods get in the way of that.
Absolutely.
That the space is more like a synapse
right.
in the brain.
Right, right.
And you just keep it going, keep
it's
it moving.
It's a connection instead of, instead of a division.
That's right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Or it's a division that's also a connection, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's maybe a better way of putting it, yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. And, you know, one of the things I wanted to ask you about your enjambments, because, you know, I enjoy them quite a bit, and, you know, vis-a-vis the music of your poetry. In fact, there's a lot of times in your poems when you have rhymes, whether they're intentional or unconscious rhymes or, you know, incidental rhymes. And I kind of wanted to ask you about that, too. I wanted to kind of ask you as being the kind of poet who follows language in such a way that it inevitably leads to rhymes, do you sometimes have to suppress the rhymes, or do you sometimes bring them out? And I suspect that sometimes you have to suppress them, that there's a little too many rhymes sometimes, and so you have learned how to make them more subtle. My question is, if there's a fight between an enjambment and a rhythm, what wins?
Oh, wow. I'm not sure that I actually know how to answer that. if there's a fight between an enjambment,
like
and
you
rhythm,
see a great enjambment and you say, "Oh, that's perfect. I want that," but it just kind of impedes the rhythm of the poem.
Yeah.
Which would win out?
Yeah, I think probably the rhythm, because I'm always really conscious of the music, and often I'm working sound to sound. I'm thinking about the movement of the poem and the sound of the poem, and I try to get carried away with that, and I try to float on that as much as I can. But typically, I don't think I really have to make a choice. That's not a choice that often comes up. It might come up in revision,
right?
But probably not in the actual
right. Right.
Writing.
That's what I would assume it would be
the
revision process, because
yeah.
It seems like you're the kind of poet that just opens your mouth or your metaphorical mouth and the poems just come out.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I revise a lot.
Yeah.
And I'm always trying to make sure that the poems are interesting and complicated on the page, but also that they are poems that sound like something in the air. Mm-hmm. And so often when I'm revising for sense, but I'm also revising for sound. I'm revising for music.
Can I ask a question about music?
Yeah.
As long as we're here. So Daniel began this interview with this question about Dean Young and the dedication in the book saying, Dean Young saved my life. If I recall correctly, the phrase right before after that is punk rock saved my life.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that and maybe the relationship between punk rock and your work as a poet?
Yeah. I started playing in punk rock bands when I was 14 or 15 years old. And it really opened my eyes socially, politically, musically, in ways that my eyes had not been opened. Changed probably the trajectory of my life in a lot of ways. I was so thrilled by and enthralled with the music, thrilled with the intensity, thrilled with the speed, thrilled with the sense that, you know, it might fall apart at any second. And also these bands were singing about things that mattered, that there was a real sort of message to the music. And it really did sort of focus me in a way that has carried through into my poetry, because I want the poems too to have speed. I want the poems to have intensity. I want the poems in some ways to feel like they might fall apart at any second. I mean, that's another part
of the
spaces and the lack of punctuation. Punctuation in some ways is, as I was saying before, a kind of roadblock or a sort of wall. Mm-hmm. I don't want that to be there. I want the poems to come together in a sort of unified form. I want them to be beautiful objects, but I don't want them to be airtight. I don't want them to be nailed to the page. I want them to have some play in them. I want them to feel like they're unstatic and alive. Punk rock for me was definitely my first encounter with music that I felt like was unstatic and alive and angular and dissonant and ferocious. Mm-hmm. And the first poems that I really came to love were also poems that had a similar kind of ferocity, that had a similar kind of vehemence to them and wildness. So punk rock has been super important to me as a poet, not just because I reference it a lot in the poems, but because my poetics depend on music and speed and precariousness and ferociousness and also love, sort of radical love, intensity of feeling of all kinds. And I think, too, you know, punk rock was the first time that I felt like I was a kind of awkward kid. and it was the first time that I felt like I was part of a community, a collaborative community, and a generative community, one that was making things by any means necessary in that sort of DIY, do-it-yourself spirit. And it really, you know, as I said before, gave me like a real focus, and it gave me permission to make noise, to make a mess.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I don't know punk rock very well, but, you know, I'm oftentimes attracted to it. And I think one of the reasons why I'm attracted to it is because it kind of takes the form of rock, of metal, and it pushes against it and does something different. And I'm wondering if that push against the form, that possibility that the poem is going to fall apart, if that tension itself is something that you seek in your poetry.
Absolutely.
You know, that's what Lorca would call duende.
Yeah.
You know, fighting against the form. And that tension itself is really a part of the whole experience of a good book of poems, because if it's too perfect, then it borders on formulaic, which
is a
completely different meaning.
Yeah. And I love that. I love the idea of the duende and the sort of, you know, the fear of the presence of death that like rises up, right? And I think one of the things I'm always trying to create in my poems, if not that specifically, at least the fear of the presence of the collapse of the poem itself.
Right, right.
And so those things are definitely related to each other.
That is a perfect segue into this question that I have to ask you before you leave. The description from the publisher, it says, these poems flash and bang with human defiance against death in all its disguises. And I'm thinking about the many references or acknowledgments of death here. There's one poem on page 107 called Last Poem, Texas, and there's a line where the speaker of the poem is looking at his dog, who's named Sarge, and he says, this may be the last poem Sarge appears, and in which I don't remember the exact language. And then in another poem, the speaker is listening to the song Angel of Death by Slayer. And then on another poem, I have this, I want to read this entire line. It says, the ghost of John Keats has lately been seen beside me when I read poems in public, and the ghost of Gregory Corso glows whitely in my fist cuffs. You spent a lot of time with the dead and a lot of time with death. And I want to ask you a question, and this is kind of a silly way of asking it, and I'm very aware of its silliness, but I'll have a follow-up on it. Is Matt Hart, what are your thoughts on death?
My thoughts on death are various and often. You know, I'm 46, soon to be 47, and I think that, you know, my earlier poems didn't dwell as much on death as they do now. I mean, and I think
it's because you were younger.
I was younger. I was
ready to study Kabbalah.
I was immortal back then. And then, you know, my daughter was born in 2006. There's something about, you know, having a child that really changes your perspective on everything, and you start to think about.
Oh, I bet. I had a dog and my perspective changed. I can't imagine what a child would be like.
And you start to think about the fact that things will not always be as they are, and that eventually things that you know, things that you are, will pass away and be no longer. And, you know, that sense of, the sense of anxiety, the sense of dread that comes with that is something that I'm constantly aware of, even in the midst of also being aware of the great joy of the present. I mean, I'm always, right, I'm trying to focus in my poems on the present moment as much as I possibly can. But of course, death creeps in, and I'm trying to find a way often to shine a light wherever that darkness comes to find me, and to think about present intensity and joy and possibility, even in the face of knowing that eventually there won't be any more possibility for me.
Wow, that's fantastic. You know, I have this idea that when we follow language into some sort of imagistic or rhythmic landscape, that we encounter those antepasados who, you know, kind of have taken us there before. And so in essence, to enter a poem is to enter a landscape where the dead dwell just as easily as the living.
Absolutely.
And I think your landscapes are just absolutely fantastic. And Matt, I have so many questions I want to ask, but we're running out of time. And so I'm wondering if you could read a short poem from your latest book, Radiant Companion Poems.
Sure. Is there one in particular you'd like for me to read? Or
actually, there is a poem. I just finished writing this story called The Locksmith. And so when I got your collection, I naturally went to that poem because I think the locksmith itself is such an archetypal image that you're certainly to confront a lot of the dead as you're talking about it, so to speak. But anyway, I love that poem, The Locksmith, and I'm wondering if you would read that one?
Sure.
Here's Matt Hart reading Locksmith.
The Locksmith. Dear true love, through the pain in my head, I'm a dot on the edge of the evening looking out, looking over and over. Stupid sky with all its blood, and parking lots on parking lots as far as the eye can see. They sprawl and spit and yearn for us. Wheels on the bus go round and round, all black everything, sparkling moonlight or almost moonlight. It's dusk in Cincinnati now. An Angel of Death by Slayer wafts up, meanders across the car's expanse, expanding. And like a scarecrow on the horizon, cut in half by earth and sky, a locksmith in his 70s, working out of his car, is helping a family locked out of their car. A family of immigrants locked out of their country. A family of eagles locked out of the sea. The locksmith is thinking how foreign they are. Probably illegals, but he can't be sure. And also, He's thinking rather sadly about moss, how it becomes us, or we it, eventually.
And there is no period after that eventually. I love the effect of that. And you know what the other thing that I really admire about this poem? I think it's beautiful, the image itself, the incident. But in this poem, the language allows you to push a bit on that metaphor of the family being locked out of the car. Because a normal poem, you would just stop with that image. But here you just kind of play with the metaphor a little bit.
Yeah.
Is it the language that let you do that? I mean, I don't suspect you decided, I want this to mean this, but you just kind of followed that.
Yeah, I definitely just followed that. I mean, that is based on an actual experience that my family had with a locksmith who was obviously, probably pretty racist in his thinking. And it really struck me and stung me. Mm. And I sat down and wrote that poem and tried to understand something about how I was feeling about it, and mm-hmm. tried to understand something about him.
Yeah,
somehow,
well, it's a beautiful poem, and yeah, I mean, if somebody is going to be a locksmith and can let us into anything, we would hope that they would be, well, at the very least, not racist.
Yeah.
Thank you, Matt Hart, for joining us. Jeff Turkin, thank you also
thank you so much.
For joining us and for introducing me to the poetry of Matt Hart. The book is Radiant Companion. It's a companion book to Radiant Action. Check it out, and thank you for joining us on Words on a Wire. And I'd like to thank our technician, Felipe Talavera, and we'll see you next week.